and she'd recognized some of them. Supersonic flying wings, immense old B-52s originally deployed in the Vietnam War and still going strong. The tiny, fast, stealth fighter bombers. Ranjit counted at least a dozen different types of aircraft, all heading to the same point on the map. And then, suddenly and without warning, they weren't. To Ranjit, it looked like nothing as much as one of those radio dog fences where the animal gets a shock from buried wiring any time he tries to pass a certain point in his run. The planes did the same thing. As they reached a certain point along the perimeter of a circle drawn with the Katara Depression as its center, the orderly patterns of V's faltered, ceased to be coherent, one by one lost power. Nothing exploded. There were no flames and no sign of enemy action. All that happened was that the mighty air fleet no longer displayed the torches of flame that were their jet exhausts. Those had winked out. Lacking thrust, the planes did their best to glide to the ground, but their best was very poor. Within a matter of minutes, the screens were displaying 500 or 600 funeral pyres, each marking the point at which a member of the mighty striking force had hit the ground, the fuel that remained in its tanks immediately exploding. And within the perimeter of the invaders' camp, the various bits of busy machinery, paying no attention at all, kept right on with their arcane tasks. For the 1.5s themselves, the Katara Depression was pure heaven. They particularly loved the brackish water of the oasis. It was purer than any water they had seen for generations on their own planet. Oh, sure, there were a few chemicals that had to be filtered out, but there were hardly any radioactive contaminants and no positron emitters at all. And the air! You could very nearly breathe it without a filter. True, it was on the warmish side, around 45 degrees centigrade, or perhaps 110 degrees Fahrenheit, in the several confusing ways the human population had of measuring temperatures. But once they had finished digging their tunnel from the depression to the sea, there would be plenty of cooling Mediterranean waters to make the climate livable. They were, in fact, about as happy as an enslaved race of largely prosthetic beings can be, except for one annoying thing. As usual, it was the Nine Limbs who were making trouble. The Nine Limbs had agreed to the destruction of the attacking aircraft because no actual local sentient lives were endangered, all of the warplanes being, of course, remotely controlled. But, infuriatingly, the attack had destroyed some human life anyway. A party of oil prospectors had had the bad luck to be setting up their seismometers just where one of the American bombers crashed. True, only 11 human beings had been killed, less than 0.0000001% of the human race. By any rational count, that was hardly enough to worry about. But the Nine Limbs kept caterwauling about it. Human ideas of justice and reparations were not the same as their own, as they knew from eavesdropping on every major human activity and a good many minor ones. Finally, the Council of the 1.5s gave in. "What can we do to heal the situation?" they asked. "That is, other than leaving this extraordinarily inviting place to go back to our own planet, which we are not going to do." "Reparations," said the experts of the Nine Limbs at once. "You must pay them. Through our eavesdropping program, we have ascertained that nearly anything that goes wrong in the affairs of these human beings can be repaired by paying reparations in the form of money. Would you be willing to do that?"
It didn't take the 1.5s long to answer that question.
"Of course we will," their leaders said at once. "What is money?"
Chapter 44 International Disagreements. A day later, and quite a distance from Katara, the Subramanian family was finishing breakfast. Natasha and Robert were already in their swimsuits, just waiting out the statutory and mother-enforced period of 30 minutes of delay after a meal before they could head for the beach. Ranjit, a cooling cup of tea in his hand, was frowning at the screen. What it showed was the bustling 1.5 colony as seen from one of the few still human-controlled satellites, and Ranjit had been frowning at it for some time. When Myra thought about it at all, she did wonder what her husband found so absorbing on the screen, though her mind was mostly on the morning's assortment of incoming texts. She held one up for a better look and called to Ranjit, "Harvard wants to know if you're interested in doing their commencement address again. Oh, and here's one from Yoris. He says they keep getting threatening messages, but if there actually are any Satanists planning to really attack Skyhook, they're not within 20 kilometers of the base, and..." "Wait, what's that?" What stopped Myra right there was a startled, "Huh?" from her husband. And when she looked up, she saw why. The aerial view was gone. The satellite had been preempted again by the aliens for their own purposes, and a familiar figure was taking shape on the screen. Behind Myra, her daughter snapped, "Oh, hell, it's me again." It was. Or at least it was that indestructible not Natasha, little curl hanging over her left ear, that had been displayed so frequently since the world had begun to fall apart. Myra sighed. "I do wish you'd had a little more clothes on," she offered, and was spared her daughter's withering reply as the figure began to speak.
"I am bringing you a message from the persons identified as the 1.5s currently located in what is called the Katara Depression on the planet you call Earth. The message is as follows. We are deeply regretting loss of human life in defense against attack. We will pay reparations up to 1,000 metric tons of 99 5/9 pure metallic gold, but require 90 days for processing metal from seawater. Please inform that offer is accepted. This ends their message."
The figure disappeared. The shiny structures of the colony popped up, and Ranjit turned around to gaze at his wife and children. He said incredulously, "I guess they've really made a sort of stock copy of Tashi they can use to make their announcements." Myra was diffidently smiling. "I don't know, but did you hear what they said? It almost sounds good. If they're willing to try to make up for what happened, there's some hope." Ranjit nodded thoughtfully. "You know," he said in wonder, "it's been so long since there was any good news that I don't know how to celebrate it. A drink all around?" "It's too early," Natasha said at once. "Anyway, Robert doesn't drink, and neither do I, much. You people do what you want. He and I are going to the beach." "And I think I'll call the office. I wonder what Davud Boy thinks about it," Ranjit said, kissing his wife's hand.
"Go then, all of you," Myra said. She sat silently, thoughtful for a moment. Then she sighed, poured herself some fresh tea, and allowed herself to relapse into what was beginning to look like a once again normal world. Thoughts of destruction and disaster had not entirely vanished from her mind. They were bearable now, though, no more distracting than the occasional twinge in a molar that reminds you to make an appointment with the dentist. Oh, not for next month, necessarily, but maybe the month after. So Myra went back to the morning's texts. There was one from her niece, Ada Labruy, to say hopefully that this machine-stored state the alien creatures talked about sounded a lot like something resembling the artificial intelligence she herself had been working on for what seemed like her whole life. And did Natasha have any possible way, any way at all, of asking them for details? A dozen texts from other people, all sharing the delusion that the real Natasha might somehow be able to get a message to the aliens. And, worryingly, a text from the Trincomalee Temple reporting that the old monk, Suraj, had come through his most recent surgery well enough, but that the long-range outlook was doubtful at best. Lips pursed in concern, Myra reread the saddening words. Suraj himself had called to tell them that he would have to have another procedure, but he had made it sound like the approximate equivalent of a tonsillectomy. This text sounded a good deal more serious. She sighed and turned to the next one, and scowled. This one was addressed to Ranjit personally. It came from Orion Bledsoe,
and what it said was, "This is to remind you of the obligations under the Uniform Military Service Act of 2014 of the American citizen Natasha de Souza Subramanian. She may report to any U.S. Army installation for the purpose of evaluation. This must be done within the next 8 days, or penalties will be incurred."
It was too late to catch Natasha to tell her about this new proposal for her life's career. Ranjit, however, was within shouting range, and when Myra had got him off the phone and handed him the message, he said, "Huh," and then to clarify his meaning, "Hell." So now the Subramanian family had a new and totally unexpected set of worries. It had never occurred to either Ranjit or Myra that the geographic fact of their daughter's birth on American soil had ever given America any right to commandeer her services. There was one clear step to be taken, and they took it. When Ranjit urgently sought help from Gamini Bandara, his old friend put him on hold for a moment, and then, with apologies, for a much longer period. When he came back, though, he sounded less worried. "Ranjit," he said, "you're still there. Good. Well, I've spoken to my father, and he's already on the phone with his legal people. He wants you to come down here." He paused for a moment, and when he went on, he sounded almost embarrassed. "The problem is that slimeball Bledsoe. We need to talk about him, Ranj. Dad'll send a plane for you. Bring Myra and Natasha, and, oh hell, Robert, for that matter. We'll be waiting." The plane that arrived for them that evening wasn't anywhere nearly as big as the one that had rescued Ranjit from rendition. It had only one stewardess, and she was nowhere near as pretty as the others, but it did have something unexpected, though. It had an old friend standing in the doorway to welcome them. Myra looked at him twice, and then broke into a smile. "Dr. Desaram, what a nice surprise!" Nigel Desaram, the man who had once been Ranjit's lawyer, now President Bandara's Secretary of State, submitted to a hug, and then waved everyone to the seats that surrounded a long table. "We'll talk on the way," he said, strapping himself in. While the plane was racing down the takeoff strip, he read the text Myra had brought for him, and by the time they were approaching cruising altitude, he was ready. He turned to Natasha. "I believe what must be done is clear. I accessed all the U.S. law and court decisions that bear on this matter while I was on the way down. The first thing for you to do is renounce American citizenship. The papers should be drawn up by my office by the time we arrive. It would be better if you'd done it years ago, of course," he added. "My fault for not making sure you did."
"Then that's all we have to do to settle this?" Ranjit asked incredulously. If the mightiest power on earth was trying to put his daughter into its uniform, he was not prepared to take chances. The old lawyer looked shocked.
"Of course not. It just means the whole matter gets fought out in the American courts, but that will take years, and I don't know if you've been paying attention. There's a presidential election coming up in America. It looks like the present administration isn't likely to win. I'm hoping the next one won't have quite the same policies. Meanwhile, you should stay out of America, please."
Natasha threw her arms around him. "Thank you," she breathed. Her father, sounding embarrassed, echoed the thanks and added, "I guess we didn't need to drag you down here."
"Ah," the lawyer said, "that's another question, isn't it? President Bandara wants to talk to you about the American ex-marine named Orion Bledsoe."
That was when Myra came in.
"He's the one who cooked up the idea of drafting Tashi."
The lawyer shook his head.
"It's unclear whether it was his idea or if it came from higher up. What I do know is that he's the one who is now in Brussels to talk to people at the World Bank."
Myra looked more worried. "What about?" she asked.
"He's giving them their orders from the Americans," the lawyer said grimly. "They're preparing a statement to release tomorrow morning, and it's going to say that such an influx of gold can't be permitted because it would unbalance the world's financial structure."
Ranjit frowned, pursing his lips.
"It might at that," he conceded.
"That would amount to an overnight injection of, what, trillions of dollars of new capital. There would be serious repercussions, not to mention what it would do to the price of gold on the world markets."
Then he shrugged. "I don't envy you, sir. I don't see how to deal with that kind of problem." But the lawyer was shaking his head.
"I think the president would not agree," At least he hopes that you can help. All of you. He'll be joining you shortly, and he wants to hear all about this Bledsoe person. Then he wants to try to work out some solutions.
The president of Sri Lanka was not the only world leader to convene a sort of brain trust. All over the planet, some of the world's smartest and best-informed people were wrestling with the same questions. Pax Perfidum had convened gatherings of their own, and their headquarters was working what satellites it could command to collect these best and brightest voices. And, who knows, they might have succeeded if the Americans had not had one more monkey wrench to throw into the works. It was an announcement presented as routine by the administration's usual spokesperson, but not routine at all in its effect on the situation.
"The president would like it understood," the spokesperson said, smiling into the camera the girl next door's smile that had served her through 100 unpalatable announcements, "that America, too, has a valid claim for reparations due to the unnecessarily severe damage inflicted on its peacekeeping aircraft."
Chapter 45 Searching for a Solution. When Nigel de Saram escorted the Subramanian family into the presidential offices, what struck Ranjit first was how much Datusena Bandara had aged. That wasn't entirely unexpected. The president had to be pushing 90. But now he seemed a good deal more fragile than the last time Ranjit had been in a room with him at his inaugural, though when he welcomed them his voice was clear and strong. He kissed both Myra and Natasha and gave an impressively youthful handshake to both Ranjit and Robert, a performance followed by his son, with the difference that Kamini gave both of the male Subramanians hugs instead of handshakes.
"Thanks for coming," Kamini said. "We've got tea coming for the grown-ups," he winked at Natasha, who returned an appreciative smile for her promotion, "and fruit juice for Robert. And if Robert gets tired of hearing us talk, there's a game machine by the window."
"That will be fine," Myra told him. "He likes to play 3D chess against the machine."
"Good, then. Did Nigel straighten out your problems with the draft?"
"I think so. Hope so, anyway," Ranjit said.
"Then let's get down to business. Old Orion Bledsoe is giving us a lot of trouble. Let's start, please, with hearing what he's doing with you."
Nigel de Saram answered that one quickly and concisely. Gamini bobbed his head and addressed the Subramanians. "Did you happen to notice where his message came from?" Myra shook her head. Ranjit frowned.
"Actually, I did notice something. It wasn't from Washington, wasn't from his California office either. I think it might have been someplace in Europe."
Gamini glanced at his father, who nodded soberly.
"It was Brussels," the president said. "Because of American pressure, the World Bank has ordered the Egyptians to refuse the gold offer, and it was Colonel Bledsoe who applied the pressure."
Kamini Bandara spoke up.
"The whole thing is my fault," he said.
"Bledsoe looked like the man I could use to get you the clearance you needed to join us at Pax Perfidum."
"That whole clearance thing was the American government's doing, of course. They didn't want anybody involved with Silent Thunder who didn't have maximum security clearance, and Bledsoe looked like somebody who could get it for you."
He shook his head gloomily.
"Bad decision. I should have gone a different way. He's been trouble ever since."
His father said, "There's no point talking about blame. The thing is, what can be done? Egypt really needs money." Myra was frowning. "Why do they have to listen to the World Bank? Why not just accept the space people's offer?"
"Ah, my dear Myra," the president said ruefully. "If only they could. The bank would have to retaliate, cancelling funds it has the power to cancel, withholding grants it can withhold, and just slowing down everything else." He shook his head. "Sadly, the Americans are not wrong about the effects of such an infusion of new capital. It would cause terrible problems in the international markets. It would bankrupt us here."
He looked down. Seated, cross-legged on the floor next to him, Natasha Subramanian was giving signs of distress.
"Did you want to say something, my dear?" he asked.
"Well, yes," she confessed.
I mean, why is Egypt poor? I thought the high dam at Aswan made them rich.
The president smiled sadly.
A good many people thought that. Aswan can produce a great deal of electric power, but it can't do two things at once. When it's maxing the power production, it is cutting power from agriculture, and they need food even more. He shook his head. The money could do wonders for Egypt, build hundreds of new power plants, for instance.
Why can't they do that anyway? Natasha asked. The president gave her a tolerant look.
They'd love to, he said. They can't. They don't have the money. They haven't had it for a long time.
So the only way they've been able to build new plants is what they call the BOOT scheme. Build, own, operate, transfer. Private industry pays for building the plants and it owns them, collecting all the profits for a period of years before transferring them to the state. But by then they are pretty elderly plants and maybe not quite as safe as they should be.
He shook his head again.
All this, he added, is what my old friend Hamid told me in confidence. It would be unpleasant for him if the Americans found out he told me about it.
Natasha sighed.
So what can we do then?
She got an answer from an unexpected source. Robert looked up from his work screen.
Odan Ul, he said reprovingly.
Nigel Disarum gave him an affectionate look.
You could be right about that, Robert, he said.
Kamini Bandara frowned.
What's he right about?
Why, the golden rule. You know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's the simplest description of a benevolent world I know, and if everybody did it, us, the Americans, the space aliens, everyone, I'm sure a good many problems would simply vanish.
Kamini looked doubtfully at his father's old friend.
No disrespect, sir, but do you really think these 1.5s are going to be moved by an ancient saying from some primitive people's some people's religion, I mean?
Oh, but I do, the lawyer said firmly. That golden rule is not just a religious notion. Others have said the same thing, in other words, without invoking supernatural authority. There was Immanuel Kant, the pure reason man, for example. What he said was,
Disarum closed his eyes for a moment, then repeated the well-learned sentences.
Act only according to that maxim whereby you can at the same time will that it should become a universal law.
Isn't that Robert's golden rule exactly? What Kant called it was his categorical imperative. By that he meant that it was what every human being, and I guess every space alien too, if Kant had ever let himself imagine such things, should establish as his basic rule of behavior, with no exceptions. He tousled Robert's hair affectionately.
Now, Robert, he said, all you have to do is get your father to prove that particular theorem, and the world will become a better place.
He glanced across the room to where Ranjit had placed himself before the screen that displayed the 1.5's multitudinous activities.
Care to try it, Ranjit? He called.
When Ranjit looked up at last, the expression on his face was seraphic, but he wasn't looking at Nigel Disarum.
Kamini, he said, do you remember when, years and years ago, you and I were discussing something from a lecture I'd wandered into, about an idea the Israelis had? They called it a hydro-solar project for generating power at the Dead Sea.
Kamini took no more than half a second to search his ancient memories.
No, he said, what are you talking about?
I finally figured out why the 1.5s might be digging that tunnel, Ranjit said triumphantly. Perhaps they're building a power plant. All right, the Americans won't let the aliens give the Egyptians all that money, but the Americans can't object to the aliens sharing some of the electrical power the Egyptians really need.
Worrier, who knew that quite well, sighed.
And when the Grand Galactics come back, what will we tell them?
The nine-limbed gave her an impatient hiss.
They will return 1 second from now, perhaps, or in 10,000 years. Time is not the same for them. You know the Grand Galactics.
Warrior gazed at the nine-limbed in silence for a moment. Then, shivering inside her light armor, she said,
"Actually, we don't know them at all. However, having no better alternative, we accept the proposal, and if we are lucky, by the time the Grand Galactics come back, we may all be dead."
Before Warrior would come back into the command center, she insisted that it be flushed with ionized gases. Even so, she paused in the doorway to sniff before entering. This caused the other occupants to do the 1.5 equivalent of exchanging amused smiles. The one called Manager, however, was the only one who spoke up.
"They are gone, Warrior," he called to her. "Even their smells are gone. There is no longer anything to be afraid of."
Warrior gave him a reproving look as she took her seat, but he was, after all, not only her superior in the 1.5 hierarchy, but, when possible, her mate.
"You know I am not afraid of the nine limbs," she informed him, and even more the others in the room. "Would you like me to tell you why I dislike them?"
Manager said meekly, "Please do, Warrior."
"It is not because of their offensive odor," she said, "and not because their ninth limb, which is their organ for manipulating things, is also their sexual organ. These things are unpleasant. Sometimes they even use that limb to touch me, which is offensive, but they cannot help their biology, can they?"
"No, Warrior, they cannot," Manager confirmed, and there were shrill hisses of agreement from the others in the room.
"What they can help, however, is the way in which we can teach and mentor the aborigines of this planet as they grow to be as civilized as we are. We can no longer accept that all our dealings with them must be through the nine limbs, since only they can speak their languages."
The hisses abruptly dried up. Even Manager was silent for a moment before venturing,
"Our superiors do not want us to be able to talk to other races directly. That is why only the nine limbs have been authorized language skills."
Warrior was steadfast.
"But our superiors are not here now. We have only one proper course for the future. We must begin at once to learn human languages. Or would you prefer that when these human beings grow up, they take after the nine limbs instead of us?"
Chapter 46 Deal-Making. Since important decisions were to be made, some 18 or 20 of the visitors from space were crowded together, nine limbs and 1.5s alike, even including a couple of the machines stored, who were the Armada's pilots. The place they were in had once been the equivalent of an admiral's bridge for the 1.5's invading armada. Now it was the approximate equivalent of a Kremlin or an Oval Office. The crowding was distasteful to the 1.5's, since most of them were wearing only the minimal protective garb, and thus were more exposed than ever before to the sounds, sights, and smells of all these others. Of all the 1.5s, the one least happy with all those unwanted sensory inputs was the one charged with keeping them out of trouble. Her official title was Identifier of Undesirable Outcomes, but she was usually called just Warrior. Actually, what Warrior disliked most of all was being compelled to sit through a lecture on antique human technology as delivered by the chief arbitrator of the Nine Limbs. When you came right down to it, Warrior didn't really care for nine limbs in any relationship, especially one that might involve touching their nasty little ninth limbs. But sometimes she had no choice. The bit of human gadget building they were now being taught was quite important to the humans. Actually, it was not uningenious, Warrior admitted to herself. Water would come from the sea, drop to the floor of Katara, and there turn turbines to generate electricity.
And this electricity,
Warrior said to the speaker for the nine limbs, is what these creatures want. The nine limbed said,
It is what you promised them. I have a copy of the agreement if you wish to see it.
The creature was actually holding out a data rod in its manipulating limb. Warrior shuddered and moved a bit away. Since she did not want these negotiations to fail, she offered a more constructive comment.
When you first proposed this, she said, I thought you were considering teaching them the harvesting of vacuum energy as we do it. I am glad we aren't doing that. When the Grand Galactics come back, it might anger them.
The nine-limbed did not respond. Warrior pressed,
And this matter of what they call the categorical imperative?
The nine-limbed covered a yawn.
It is how these creatures wish to run their planet. They want us to do the same, and actually—
It leveled its ninth limb at one of the machine-stored pilots, who was following the conversation with his own nine-limbed translator.
Some technology transfer has already begun.
Chapter 47 Parting. When Ranjit and Myra went back to see Suraj, it was quite a bit after their previous meeting, two surgeries later by the way the old monk had come to count time. By then their world, the world of everyone alive on Earth, was new twice over, and still changing.
It's not just the technology, either, Ranjit told his wife. It's, well, friendlier than that. All the Egyptians hoped for was a share of the Katara power. The 1.5s didn't have to give them all of it.
Myra didn't immediately respond, so Ranjit gave her a quick look. She was gazing out at the waters of the Bay of Bengal with what might have been a slight smile on her face. When she felt her husband's eye on her, the smile broadened.
Huh, she said.
Ranjit, laughing, turned his attention back to the road.
My darling, he said, you are full of surprises. Have you run out of things to be suspicious of?
Myra considered. Probably not. Right now I can't think of any big ones, though.
Not even the Americans.
She pursed her lips. Now that that horrid Bledsoe man is a fugitive from justice, no. I think the president isn't going to make any more waves for a while. Bledsoe is what deniability was invented for.
Ranjit listened quietly, but what he was thinking was not really about what she was saying. More than anything else, he was thinking about Myra herself, and in particular, what incredibly good fortune he had to have her.